Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see
some bad.
Produced
at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal legal system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. On this edition of Prison Pipeline, standing on the fiscal cliff. The Oregon State Legislature is currently out of session. During this interim period, however, legislative offices continue to work. Committees and task forces meet for a few days every 8 weeks for legislative days to hold hearings on policies and to debate legislative concepts which may and will eventually be introduced as bills when the legislature officially reconvenes each January. This year, the interim work has become even more vital because, thanks to the federal government, Oregon, like many other states, is perched on a fiscal cliff. Part of the problem is the federal budget bill, with its cuts to Medicaid and to food assistance. Beyond that, however, changes to the federal tax code are having an enormous impact on Oregon because the state's tax laws are tied to the federal tax code. An attempt was made in the 2025 session to decouple state tax law from the feds, House Bill 2092. The measure passed the House on a vote of 34-16, then went to the Senate. HB 2092 was assigned to the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. One hearing was held in April, and that was it. Never made it out of committee. The Senate adjourned June 27th, and the bill died. Oopsie. In an op-ed published November 24th in the state's biggest newspaper, The Oregonian, the co-chairs of the Oregon Legislature's Joint Interim Committee on Ways and Means, Senator Kate Lieber and Representative Tana Sanchez, wrote, quote, "Because Oregon's tax laws are tied to the federal tax code, the state is now expecting to collect $900 million less to fund public services than previously projected." End quote. The budget passed by the legislature earlier this year projected a surplus of nearly $475 million. Thanks to the feds, that surplus is now a deficit of nearly $375 million. States can't run deficits. That's why the most recent legislative days, which ran from November 17th through the 19th, were dominated by discussions of budget cuts across all agencies. So on this edition of Prison Pipeline, we're going to look at what may happen to Oregon's criminal legal system as the state tries to back away from the fiscal cliff on which we find ourselves perched. The Joint Interim Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety held its hearing to look at reduction options on November 17th. On today's show, we're going to listen to portions of that hearing. Let's start with the Judicial Department. The next voice you hear will be that of State Court Administrator Nancy Cosine. The other witness is Jessica Roser, Assistant Deputy State Court Administrator for Operations.
I'm Nancy Cosine, your State Court Administrator, and I am here with Jessica Roser, Assistant Deputy State Court Administrator for Operations. We're here to present options for reductions to the Oregon Judicial Department's budget for the 2025-27 biennium. So the judicial branch is a co-equal branch of government. Our services are essential to public safety, economic stability, and individual rights. The judicial branch is constitutionally mandated, and we don't control our workload. We can't decide how many cases get filed, and we must do everything possible to resolve cases quickly and effectively while honoring and respecting the rights of litigants and our communities. Our constitutional duty is to resolve cases completely and without delay, and that obligation does not pause when there is a recession. Statutory mandates require us to process certain cases within certain timeframes. Those timeframes exist to protect people, especially the most vulnerable, from harms caused when there is delay. We were asked to model reductions in 2.5% increments up to 5%. Our general fund operations and critical services budget is just under $706 million. Judicial compensation, which is constitutionally protected, totals $139.5 million and cannot be reduced. A reduction to this appropriation must actually come from our operations budget. So a 2.5 or 5% reduction becomes either a 3 or almost 6% reduction to our operations budget. It's also important to note that OJD's budget has very limited funding for services and supplies. 88.6 88.7% of OJD's general fund's operations budget is personal services. Historically, we've used vacancy savings to cover our additional unfunded technology costs. Therefore, any cut to OJD's budget means a reduced ability to cover technology replacements and a reduction in people hours, the court staff who run the system, and the services they provide to the public. That said, we understand the challenges you're up against, and we want to be helpful. So, Ms. Rozier will provide you with an update about the process we use to develop our reductions.
Good morning, Co-Chair Broadman, Co-Chair Evans, members of the subcommittee. I'm Jessica Rozier, Assistant Deputy SCA for Operations. As we approach this reduction exercise, our guiding principle was preserve access to justice. That meant first looking for available one-time funds like carry-forward balances and underused appropriations like third-party collections. We also focused on reductions that wouldn't compromise our legal obligations and that would minimize the long-term consequences of budget cuts. Finally, we worked hard to avoid layoffs and the dismantling of mature, high-functioning programs. The compressed timeline for reductions and the high cost of layoffs makes those types of options far less effective. Instead, we prioritized options that can be implemented immediately and reduce long-term consequences, like deferring new initiatives that haven't been fully implemented and instituting court closure days, which, while limiting access to justice, create predictability for our communities. They also allow us to manage workload more efficiently and strategically, reduce operational costs, and maintain fairness across all judicial districts. Throughout this process, we were mindful of the legal and constitutional constraints that limit our flexibility. Many of our services are mandated, and that reality shaped our approach. As we examined options, we engaged our presiding judges, court administrators, and pass-through recipients. Internally, our leadership and fiscal teams reviewed workload data, statutory mandates, and our operational needs. We prioritized based on timing, severity of impact, and legal requirements. We've already implemented a series of statewide austerity measures to capture savings as early as possible. These include delaying hiring for at least 30 days, restricting travel and in-person training, deferring equipment replacements, and eliminating non-essential purchases. These actions are helping us reduce operational costs, but they come with trade-offs. Delaying equipment replacements increases the risk of system failures, and limiting training can affect staff readiness, especially as we manage rising caseloads and new legal requirements. We've also slowed the rollout of new programs that haven't been fully implemented yet. This includes the Trauma-Informed Domestic Violence Training Program and the Ombuds Office. These are important initiatives, but we haven't hired permanent staff yet, so these are two areas where we can take one-time reductions and avoid the high costs of layoffs and the dismantling of mature programs, which can often be complex and require statutory changes. In addition, we're continuing to evaluate workload and staffing needs using our current data, and we're actively pursuing grant funding to help fill the gaps.
For the record, Nancy Cosine back again to review the reductions at the 2.5% level and the 5% level. At the 2.5% level, the bulk of reductions will be achieved through a return of carry forward balances, reductions to third party collections, and aggressive austerity measures. We've included an option to repurpose the planning funds for the Washington County Courthouse. There are significant concerns with this reduction, and it's only viable if the legislature intends to stop approving court replacement projects during the next biennium. It has serious community impacts as it would delay the county's ability to move forward with replacing a courthouse that is overcrowded, seismically unsound, and unable to support trauma-informed practices. Another difficult area included in our list is reducing pass-through funding to court-connected services. These dollars provide essential services that support access to justice for members of our community. They include county law libraries that serve as a legal resource hub for attorneys and self-represented litigants, county mediation and conciliation programs that are legally required to help families resolve disputes, legal aid, which provides access to legal help for low-income Oregonians in critical areas like domestic violence, housing, consumer debt, and immigration, and the Oregon Law Commission and Council on Court Procedures, two entities whose work improves efficiency and fairness in the court system. In addition to the across-the-board reductions to pass-through funding, we have also included the state court facilities and security account, which would reduce or delay security projects in courthouses and delay or prevent the replacement of outdated non-functional security equipment. A reduction to state law library assessments as well. Again, these have real impacts on our communities. Past the 2.5% level, we would have to delay implementation of our two new programs, trauma-informed training and the Ombuds Office. To reach the full 5% target, we would need to take additional actions that dramatically impact our communities. First on the list is a deeper reduction to pass-through entities, including third-party collections and the state court facilities and security account. This would further strain the safety net that helps people navigate the legal system without a lawyer, potentially limit the state's ability to collect court debt, and create more risk in courthouses that already suffer from a lack of security. Second, we would implement 16 court closure days, more than one per month, requiring all staff to be furloughed. This would reduce case processing time, increase backlogs, and limit public access to critical services like protective orders, treatment courts, and civil trials. Finally, court closure days would reduce our use of jurors and interpreter services. This reduction is reflected on the last line of the 5% level reduction.
Since judicial compensation cannot be reduced, if the values included in the reduction calculation, we would have to take deeper cuts from operations. For example, a 2.5% reduction is almost a 3% reduction to operations and critical services, and a 5% reduction is almost a 6% reduction to operations. We would have to take 5 additional court closure days for each 2.5% reduction to judicial compensation. And just to put a court day into perspective, our courts hold over 27,000 proceedings each day and process over 20,000 court filings of various types every single day. A 5% cut with judicial comp included would require a total of 26 court closure days, almost 2 each month. And that would have an impact on access to justice that would be felt by the public, by our partners, and by our courts.
Nancy Cosine, back again for the record, and we understand that the state is facing difficult financial decisions, and we are committed to being a part of the solution. We're also a core function of government, and our communities expect to be able to access services when they walk through our doors, whether real or virtual. In our appendices, you can find more information about the workload that we're currently managing and the workload that we see on the horizon. We need to do everything possible to structure our reductions in a way that reduces negative consequences for the public, creates transparency in our services, and preserves our ability to restore complete services and address backlogs as quickly as possible once the state economy recovers.
You just heard State Court Administrator Nancy Cosine, along with Assistant Deputy State Court Administrator for Operations Jessica Roser. They testified November 19th before the Subcommittee on Public Safety of the Joint Interim Committee on Ways and Means at a hearing to discuss options for budget reductions. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Let's hear more from that hearing. The state of Oregon's public defense crisis has been the subject of a few editions of Prison Pipeline, so I think it appropriate to hear what impact these cuts will have on the Oregon Public Defense Commission. Here's the commission's interim executive director, Ken Sanchagrin.
First, I'd like to discuss, just for a brief moment, the selection criteria that we employed as we went through our determination of what should show up on our reduction options list. Our core guiding principle that we engaged in was the prioritization of our core responsibilities under the Constitution and the maintenance of the positive momentum that we have had over the past few months in reducing the unrepresented crisis. And so chief among those, number one, is protecting the services that we are constitutionally mandated to provide to indigent clients. We also prioritize limiting impacts on our agency staff, because reductions to agency staff can impact some of our other statutorily required services that we're asked to provide to our providers, such as paying invoices and other items like that. We also, as I mentioned, wanted to prioritize the momentum we have in reducing the unrepresented crisis. And we want to really make sure to be clear on the record that as an agency, we know that we have had our budget increased over the past several biennia. We believe that we are finally in a position where we are able to meet the constitutionally mandated services that we have been ordered to provide. And so any of these reductions that are provided may impact constitutionally mandated services. And certainly any of the reductions that we have been that we have put onto our list are ones that we do not want folks to take as value judgments as to, the worth of these different programs. So as far as our agency process was concerned, as I mentioned, we started off looking for either items that were non-constitutionally or non-statutorily mandated. And those are the types of items that we tried to rank first as we went through our reduction process. We also then looked at our other reductions, and we tried to rank those according to the potential impact that they would have on pre-existing programs across the state. We began also by going from division to division within our agency, asking all managers to identify any internal reductions that could be taken relatively easily within their programs. We also engaged in a high-level discussion with our commission in our October commission meeting to try to solicit feedback from our commissioners as to programs that could be reduced or to talk about the impacts of any of the reductions that we were discussing internally. And then finally, with regards to stakeholder engagement, once the reduction lists were posted on OLIS, we've been having discussions with many of those stakeholders as to the potential impact of some of these reductions that were placed on the list. So the Oregon Public Defense Commission, I was interested to learn that we have essentially the second largest general fund numbers of any public safety agency kind of in this portfolio. And so when you look at the reductions that we have to propose, we're looking at about $34 million at the 5% level. On the next two slides, I have our 2.5% increments for us to arrive at those numbers. And so what we included on our list, I'll just briefly go down. We tried to break up our reductions wherever possible to have a staged or kind of structured approach to reductions to provide more options to the legislature. So our list is a little bit long, but you can see that approach, at least in our first reductions that we put on the list for the reduction or the elimination of county discovery payments that the commission currently passes through to counties to reimburse prosecutors for providing discovery to defense attorneys. We then have our agency impacts, which we've also labeled here, which of these impacts, most of these agency impacts were tied to the governor's reduction. And so we have those labeled here. After we get past those two buckets, we begin to get into a lot of the pass-through money that we provide across the state, whether through contracts for different types of services being provided or just to our providers more broadly. Another item that I was kind of interested to learn was that over 90% of the money that we have at the agency is to go towards the provision of public defense services, whether that's internal to our agency or through providers. And so we knew that we could not hold those harmless as we went through and at least identified different items for possible reductions. And so that's where we begin to see reductions to the Adult Trial Division. When it's labeled Adult Trial Division, that is provider contractor funds and not necessarily internal contract or internal funds for the trial division. We have a little bit of confusion there, I think, sometimes with how we refer to those different divisions that you can see on our list. The second 2.5% in some ways looks very similar to the first. We have further reductions to our contracted providers through the Adult Trial Division, but then we also have some items that would require statutory changes to enact related to dependency hearings, both within the juvenile arena or the PCRP. So this is a juvenile types of cases, but under a different standard, depending on the county that you're located in. Certainly these would require a lot, it'd be a much heavier lift to implement, but they were included to be able to get us to that final 2.5%. Certainly the impacts, as I've already mentioned in a few areas, would be wide-reaching and potentially pass expenses on into other arenas. Certainly reduction in public defense services could result in expenses being borne at DOC or in other areas if they came to fruition in the public defense arena. We also have questions about county reimbursements and what impacts those would have on the counties. And so I think that regardless of what we're looking at from a cut perspective, the impacts would be felt very widely. And that really transitions into the final question that we were asked to at least provide some testimony regarding, which is possible mitigation. We do have some of our items that we've identified that would be relatively easy for the agency to sustain, such as rent reimbursement and some of these other areas. They're relatively small dollar amounts, but they're certainly things that we would be able to mitigate relatively easily, especially relative to the much more difficult items related to actually the provision of public defense services that could have wide-ranging impacts across the state and for the indigent individuals who would either be denied those services or have a lower level of service provided to them.
That was Ken Sanchagrin, Interim Executive Director of the Oregon Public Defense Commission. He testified November 19th before the Subcommittee on Public Safety of the Joint Interim Committee on Ways and Means at a hearing to discuss options for budget reductions. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. While we have time, let's hear a bit more from that hearing. Here are Oregon Youth Authority Executive Director Mike Tessin and OYA Chief Financial Officer Caitlin Hudson.
As a reminder, we work with youth on a continuum. We have some youth with the most unmitigated risks, with the most significant treatment needs. They'll reside in the most secure environments, one of our five youth correctional facilities. Now, once some of our youth are ready for a less restrictive environment, but maybe they aren't quite ready for the community, they would be placed in one of our four transitional camps. Three of them are male specific, one is female specific. And when the youth are ready to return to the community, they're placed according to their need and situation. Maybe in their home with their families, or an independent living program, or a foster home where we recruit, certify, and manage, or a residential treatment program to address their clinical needs. So you can see that our transitional camps provide a bridge for youth who no longer require the greatest security of a correctional facility, but aren't quite ready for the community yet. It gives them an opportunity to practice independence, learn how to be an adult, how to work a job, keep a job, earn money, manage their money, and pay restitution. And everybody in this room knows that the Oregon Youth Authority has struggled with staffing since the pandemic. And I'm happy to share that in the last 6 months, we've made a lot of progress. And we know that stabilized staffing creates consistency for our young people. And when they have that consistent adult that they're interacting with on a regular basis, it creates an opportunity to build a mentoring relationship, which we know is correlated to reduced risk. We based all of our proposals on concepts that had the least negative impact on our mission and our developmental model. We talked about safety, treatment continuity, and operational feasibility. We took a systems-wide lens with the goal to minimize bottlenecks and to preserve system flexibility. We need to be able to place the right youth in the right bed at the right time so they can leave the justice system and close that chapter of their life. We considered the cascading impacts of every budget reduction we explored. We are intentional not to reduce any of our pass-through dollars to the county juvenile departments because we know every dollar we invest upstream prevents young people from coming to us in the future. We considered the community resources and capacity and the type of parole transitions that we would have to explore. We also took a look at our youth correctional facilities, acknowledging that they're the most essential to our system. The transitional camps are a valuable part of the continuum, but they're not essential to how we manage our population. We modeled several reduction combinations, asking ourselves what are the cascading impacts. Camp Florence and the Tillamook campus, which includes a youth correctional facility and a camp, emerged as the least disruptive options. Tillamook is between a design and construction phase, and if we close Tillamook, there will be savings in debt service and construction costs. Tillamook has a shared campus where they share an infrastructure between the camp and the correctional facility. Closing both just made operational sense. And also allows us to maintain the majority of our youth correctional facilities, maximizing treatment access and safety. At the Oregon Youth Authority, we're committed to efficiency, but a 5% cut would compromise the structural integrity of our system. I want to first start by focusing on the impacts of facility closures. If we close facilities to achieve savings, we lose transitional lower security placements that are essential for preparing some of our youth for release to the community. Without those intermediate steps, we face a binary choice. We keep them in a more expensive, more secure facility, or we accelerate their release. An accelerated release, we can end up with young people who might be released prematurely, which we know increases their risk to recidivate. This doesn't save money. It simply shifts the cost of failure to local law enforcement, the courts, and victims, effectively choosing to pay less now to pay far more later. Furthermore, the cuts will lead to crowded remaining facilities. And overcrowding is a direct threat to staff and youth safety. It heightens tension, increases the risk of violence, and compromises the quality of supervision. It fundamentally compromises our ability to provide safe and developmentally appropriate environments. Youth will be placed in beds based on availability, not based on what is developmentally appropriate. We'll likely see an increase in overtime, loss of experienced staff because staff quit when they don't feel safe, and it'll compromise our ability to comply with the PREA standards. And in many of the meetings I've had with you, you've asked me about McLaren, which holds around 50% of our youth in closed custody. And I'm glad to share with you that under our new superintendent, it has made steady progress towards addressing the standing issues. But I have to be honest, closing the other facilities will impact McLaren's progress. I want to zoom in on how some of the other cuts will impact our ability to be responsive to emerging issues. By cutting general service and supplies budget, we'd lose the flexibility to respond to things like the greater acuity that we see in our young people. Or maybe it's the gang affiliation or conflict resolution or contraband issues, especially in the McLaren campus. Beyond the immediate safety issues, this will compromise the long-term progress that we've already made. The Professional Standards Office has come a long way, ensuring thorough and timely investigations, and they've been resolving age cases while maintaining an increase in new complaints coming in. These cuts will interfere with our ability to provide overtime. And that lack of overtime will mean the age cases and unsigned cases will take longer to resolve, and it may result in us triaging new cases coming in. After all the progress we've made, we don't want to lose any ground and want to continue to prioritize youth and staff safety. And zooming out to the agency's operations as a whole, when I took this job, I made a commitment to you and to the governor that I would continue to overhaul the performance management system aimed at accountability, meaningful change, and transparency. And we're moving along. We actually had our second iteration with the Performance Standards Office just last week. In December, we're scheduled to start with PREA in the McLaren facility. I can honestly tell you that these cuts will impact our ability to implement this new system as effectively and quickly as we need to. And I worry about losing momentum. And that's the bottom line I want to leave you with. Our agency has made incredible strides over the last year to address all the known existing issues. And we believe we are on the right track. We're prepared for reductions, but a 5% cut would compromise our ability to create systems and structures to keep our youth and staff safe. It would impede our ability to restore the trust and credibility that we need to repair with our youth, the families, and the community. And ultimately, it would interfere with our young people's long-term success.
That was Oregon Youth Authority Executive Director Mike Tessine. They testified November 19th before the Subcommittee on Public Safety of the Joint Interim Committee on Ways and Means at a hearing to discuss options for budget reductions. The various subcommittees of the Ways and Means Committee held similar hearings during November's legislative days. Those hearing videos are available at the Oregon Legislature's website, oregonlegislature.gov. They're quite informative. If, like me, you live in Oregon, they're very worth listening to. If you don't live in Oregon, it might be a good time to check in on your state legislature to see how they're handling these federal cuts. For now, that's it. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's audio port service. Please support your local public media and community radio stations. Become members. Become volunteers. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. You'll also find a link there to subscribe to the Prison Pipeline podcast. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give its page a like and share it with friends. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long. Oh,